And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How you doing, Phil? Hey, let's remind folks right now.
Membership drive starts on Wednesday and runs through next Tuesday, and we need your membership.
Yes, sir. So get ready. Make a note.
Actually, there's still the early bird draw. There's still time. Go to PayPal, navigate.
And through their difficulties, and it, you know, it's like a little exercise, and contribute money now, and you're eligible for the draw for the iPad.
And plan on that day to call us up, because we like to hear from folks. It's an affirmation of the work we're doing.
Of course, you've got to mention the Taylor Report when you make your contribution.
We are your one-stop tailoring service. This is CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today, of course, we want to revisit an important event about which we know something, and it is the occasion of the day being April the 7th, would have been the first day of fighting between two armies in Rwanda, the government army and the army of the present president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. We're going to talk to Dr. Theogen Rudasingwa in the first half hour, and in the second, we'll be talking to Chris Black, who is a Toronto lawyer and who has represented one of the most prominent accused at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And I'll tell you what spirit we're going to be doing this in today. The best-known prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and that of the former Yugoslavia, I would argue, is Carla Del Ponte. And of course, Canadians will remember the
Louise Arbour, but who?
Louise Arbour of Canada. And, of course, there was Mr. Goldstone, was the first prosecutor. He stepped aside really before the proceedings began. But Carla Del Ponte has written her memoir, her experience, called Madam Prosecutor. And she said this about the investigating of the events of April the 6th, 1994. And she says, you'd have to starting at the wrong line. She says, the task of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, quote, was to establish a record of events that would contribute to reconciliation of the Hutu and Tutsi communities. Failure to investigate the RPF would send an unambiguous signal that the Tutsi leaders enjoyed impunity, that they were above the law, that the involvement, that the innocent victims of their violence did not count. This failure would not bode well for Rwanda, or for the Rwandans scattered across Africa and beyond. The book is Madam Prosecutor by Carla Del Ponte. That would be our theme because, in fact, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda has completed its work, and no one from the Rwanda Patriotic Front has been accused or charged. And indeed, when there was a possibility that that would happen, the authorities in Kigali, which is a government that is run, dominated, owned, and operated by the Rwandan Patriotic Front, indicated they would not be very happy. And so all investigations of misbehavior, crimes against humanity, etc., that were pointed toward them were laid aside. And so we find ourselves here now, 2014, 20 years after the war and massacres that took place in Rwanda starting April 6th, with a government that enjoys impunity. I think we're joined now by Theogen Rudasingwa. Are you there, sir? Hello? Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can now. Can you hear me, Dr. Rudasingwa?
Yes, how are you today?
Very well, and I thank you very much for joining us. And I want to tell folks, by the way, that if they go to a site called therwandan.com, they will be able to read your assessment of where we stand today, 2014, all these years after the war and massacres, genocide that took place in Rwanda. And you covered in a recent speech the entire spectrum of how we came to this crisis came to be. I wonder, could we start with, I guess, the day it will live on and be revisited and debated for a long time. That would be April the 6th, 1994. There was a peace agreement. There were negotiations called the Arusha Accords. And President Habyarimana and the president of Burundi, both Hutus, were returning from Dar es Salaam. And their plane was shot down with awful consequences from that moment on. Can you tell us what you know about how that plane came to be shot down and why it was shot down, if you know?
Yes, I mean, this is, thank you very much. I mean, I've been on this show before and I've written a book, I've described that, and in my speech, which you advise people to read, that I gave in Paris on the 1st of April this year, I describe that indeed as a pivotal moment, because the shooting down of the plane, whereas I could not argue that it was the cause, but I always say it was a very powerful trigger.
Yes, so that trigger, the word trigger comes up, I notice, often.
Yes, and so, and that is precisely the sad part of modern history of Rwanda, because President Kagame and the RPF regime have distorted the whole story and have a different narrative in which they give a different kind of version of what happened. And I used to subscribe to that kind of falsification of saying that, you know, it was the Hutu extremists who killed their own president so that they could start the genocide. But of course, that is nonsense as we look back. And the fact of the matter is that President Paul Kagame himself gave the order for the shooting down of the plane. And so we could easily say that he was also a factor in the genocide against Tutsi. But most importantly, there are also massacres that took place against the Hutu. And in fact, in the Congo, it has been described that it's possible that there could have been acts of genocide. But that's another matter. The fact of the matter is that several Hutus have died and unaccounted for. And the regime simply has consistently pushed this whole version of saying, you know, this event was carried out by other people than Paul Kagame and his clique themselves. Mm-hmm. And of course, trying to deny the Hutu the opportunity to remember their own who died in Rwanda and in the Congo. And in this case, of course, they proceed. On a day like this one, we should not only remember the people who died in the genocide, mm-hmm. but also President Habyarimana's family, President Ntaryamira's family, the family of the French who perished in this plane, the ministers from Burundi who perished in the plane, and other Rwandans who perished in the plane. So for us, we push the idea that we should be allowed to remember all of us, the Tutsi, yes. the Hutu, and the Twa, because a death is a death.
But by the way, it really is treated as a crime to do just what you mentioned. I mean, we have Victoire Ingabire, candidate for president. She's an unarmed woman who returned to Rwanda from Holland and wanted to run for office. But her first thing she said was that we have to remember all those who died. And for saying that not only Tutsis died, but Hutus died, she committed, according to the government of Rwanda, a crime. Is that right?
Well, the fact of the matter is that indeed Victoire Ingabire is in jail simply because she dared to say, number one, that as a Rwandan, it was her right to contest for the post of the presidency. I think that was the most important crime, according to Paul Kagame, that she committed. How could dare she want to become a president of Rwanda? So that was the first crime. The second crime is that she dared to say that it was not only the Tutsis who perished in the genocide of 1994, that Hutus also should be allowed to mourn their own dead, that until both communities can be allowed to mourn, and be able to talk about these bitter truths that have existed between us. That until that happens, then you cannot talk about genuine reconciliation and healing. So she paid a price, but she's not the only one. As you know, there are several others in jail, but there are several other people who have died. In fact, being in jail is Kagame is a lesser price. The ultimate price that Kagame believes people must pay for speaking the truth is actually death, as it happened to my colleague and friend, Patrick Karegeya, a couple of months ago, as he has tried to assassinate my other colleague and friend, Kayumba, General Kayumba, a number of times.
Yes.
And if you look at the whole pattern from 1994 up to date, the pattern of those of what Kagame does to those who disagree with him, who tell the truth, who want to remember their own death, who point out human rights abuses, has always been: you are either in jail, or you simply keep silent, or you are dead, or you run into exile. These are the options for Kagame.
Yes. Let me, by the way, underline that point. We're speaking to Dr. Theogen Rudasingwe. His book, by the way, Healing a Nation, A Testimony, is a really detailed and thorough account of the entire matter to do with Rwanda and all of its problems, from its evolution out of colonial period and the struggles for power, both regional and ethnic. And it's a brilliant and essential book. Now, Dr. Rudasingwe, of course, I should underline too, for our listeners, you and your colleagues have been very heroic, frankly, in coming forward, General Yamwasa and your colleague Patrick Karegeya, all of whom are very, very qualified to talk about these issues. On the matter of the assassination of Habyarimana, my understanding is that your colleagues, but certainly you, have spoken to the point that you have some personal knowledge of the involvement of the president, Kagame, in the assassination. My memory is he told you he had been involved.
Oh, yes. For me, he told me. But you might recall that even before me, there are other junior people within our formerly what I call what used to be our organization, RPF, and its military wing, RPA. There are others who had given testimony. But I think the four of us, myself, my brother Gerald Gahima, General Kayumba, and my late comrade and brother Patrick Karegeya, certainly we know Kagame more intimately than all the others who have spoken the truth. I have testified before the judge, Judge Trevedic, and in fact, Patrick Karegeya might have been killed simply because you might recall at some time, I think it might have been in August last year, on an interview with the RFE, he also expressed the desire that as soon as it's possible, that he should appear before the judge and tell him what he knew to confirm that indeed President Kagame was the one responsible for this crime. And all these years, for the last 3 years, General Kayumba has expressed the same desire, that he knows for sure that President Kagame is the one responsible for this crime, and that he should, you know, have an opportunity to appear before Judge Trevedic and to tell him exactly what he knows. And in fact, today I was reading a piece he did with Al Jazeera, an interview that General Kayumba did with Al Jazeera, that he certainly knows the full account of what happened, and that should he appear in any court to tell what he knows, that he hopes that President Kagame will be standing beside him, because he's the principal accomplice in that kind of crime. And it's because of this that also Kagame perpetually or relentlessly tries to hunt down General Kayumba and has tried 3 times to kill him. So yes, I have testified to the best of my knowledge, and the remaining, certainly General Kayumba has very, very important testimony to give. But the board is, of course, in the investigators' court.
Let me remind everyone that you were the Secretary General of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and you were the Rwanda's ambassador to the United States. And you were Paul Kagame's chief of staff, so you know whereof you speak. Something very important, too. The Arusha Accords were a process where all the parties were going to create a new government. And everyone was involved in that. The Rwandan Patriotic Front was a signatory or had been a part of the Arusha process. Now, with the death of Habyarimana, fighting broke out. The interim government and certainly the general staff of the Rwandan army notified the United Nations that they were in favor of the continuation of the Arusha Accords and had no intention of doing anything other than implementing them. What was the position of the Rwanda Patriotic Front on, because this is, involves the resumption of hostilities, war?
No, two things. Of course, once the President Habyarimana died and this provisional government took charge, it also lost control of the territory, and I think it lost control of running a normal state. And I think many of them also got so much involved in the operation of carrying out genocide and the killings that took place. But most importantly, what we need to know is that the primary responsibility for derailing the Arusha Peace Agreement is actually on Paul Kagame and the RPF, because indeed this was the calculation. Kagame's calculation was to kill President Habyarimana, and he knew that in that type of country that is run on autocratic basis, that if you kill the head, then the rest of the people be in confusion, and that in that kind of confusion you have an opportunity to take over the country. And exactly that's what happened, because once he killed President Habyarimana, the whole country went into confusion. And you might recall that the same night that President Habyarimana's plane was shot, that's when Paul Kagame gave orders for the RPA to take the offensive. Mm-hmm. So the plan was to shoot down a plane, kill President Habyarimana, launch the offensive, and the likelihood is that you win the civil war. And that's exactly what happened within 100 days, because yes, the same 100 days in which the genocide was carried out was, yes, also the 100 days in which the RPF was able to take over the country.
And on that point, General Dallaire has written and testified that he didn't notice any attempt to rescue the Tutsi population of Rwanda. He said that the conduct of the Rwanda Patriotic Front was strictly a military operation to win power and was not in any way a rescue.
That's true, yes. There were certain instances in which the RPF was able to rescue some families and some individuals. In most cases, that was the result of military taking over some territory and capturing that territory and winning the contest with the government army. And of course, the other thing is that because the RPF, this is also the truth, is also the truth, because by taking over the country within 100 days, certainly the RPF also was able to recover the country and save some people who otherwise probably would have died at the hands of Interahamwe, the militia. But by and large, really, if you remember, and I described this in my book, RPF was never interested in, for example, the United Nations having a presence in Rwanda.
Yes, I wanted to ask you that.
Once the President Habyarimana died and the war resumed, they were actually never interested in this. So somehow we're even happy that the United Nations was able to leave immediately and leave their 270 of their troops. And we fought very hard at the United Nations here in Washington, D.C. to make sure that there is no other United Nations force. We fought against the unilateral French peacekeeping force in Operation Turquoise, because we knew any international presence would actually deny us the military victory that we're desperately looking for.
So yes.
I sometimes wonder when I hear Kagame making, saying, the international community this, international community that. I mean, Kagame was simply bent on capturing power at whatever price.
Mm-hmm. My memory is that the General Kagame at that time actually threatened the UN forces who might come in. He told them they were not to be there. Am I right about that?
Yes. We even said, I remember, we did send our representatives at that time to New York. People in Canada might remember one of the RPF leaders, Claude Saidi, was working with me in diplomacy, and my own brother, Gerard Gahima. We sent them to New York. They met Madeleine Albright. They met other people. And our message was, we don't need any UN peacekeepers because the Tutsis who are to die are already dead. So what are you coming to tell? I mean, lots of Tutsis were dead. There were still some, even if we had been able to save one more Tutsi, in retrospect, I would have said, let's even save that Tutsi, or let's save that Hutu. But that was the RPF's message. Don't come, because all the Tutsis who have to die have already died.
Yeah. So when Bill Clinton says, oh, I'm sorry I didn't intervene, he neglects to mention that Paul Kagame didn't ask him to intervene.
Well, in fact, we were trying to put pressure on the Americans to make sure that there's no UN force. And of course, we knew that the Americans were very important in that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very, very disappointed with Madeleine Albright and with the Americans when they stood to accept the French.
Operation Turquoise.
Operation Turquoise. So, of course, President Clinton is being very dishonest, and it's very disappointing that he does so.
Yes. It's very odd that the U.S. claims to be the main power that let everybody down, but also they seem to be the closest power to the present government, together with the British and Mr. Blair. And you list, by the way, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and, by the way, curiously enough, a man named Rick Warren, for making sure that the influence comes from London and Washington. And the friendship runs that way, despite the fact that allegedly these are the countries that let the country down.
Yes, surprisingly. But, you know, countries sometimes behave in very strange ways based on their what they call their national interests. And I think the Americans and the British were happy that the French were vacating Rwanda. And so the new powerful guys on the block are the Americans and the British. And the principal advocates of Kagame right now, globally, Tony Blair, President Clinton, and the evangelist Rick Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and of course, since 1994, every time there have been efforts, either through the International Criminal Tribunal or through other processes to hold Kagame accountable for human rights abuses in Rwanda and in the Congo, or the war that is launched against Congo leading to several millions that have died in the Congo, very often the people who have shielded him, who have protected him, are the governments of the United Kingdom and Washington. I'm glad that at least now there is some kind of evolution here in Washington, where they are beginning to see that Kagame's policies and actions in the Congo are very dangerous and very destabilizing. And you might recall that President Obama called Kagame to tell him that he should, you know, stop the operations through M23. And when my friend Patrick Aregea was assassinated by Kagame in South Africa, and subsequently they attempted to assassinate General Kayumba, Washington came out publicly to say that they condemn it and that they are troubled, which is a very soft diplomatic term of saying we are not happy with you. It's like a slap on the wrist. But coming from Washington, where in the past the general tendency has been to protect Kagame, I think that's an interesting evolution, and we hope that hopefully in the near future Kagame will become too much of an embarrassment.
Yes.
To the extent that maybe they'll be forced to drop him, because certainly supporting Kagame is a very unsustainable and dangerous business.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Dr. Teyajan Rudasingwa, author of Healing a Nation, A Testimony, Waging and Winning a Peaceful Revolution to Unite and Heal a Broken Rwanda. And I want to read you something. We opened the show with this line. I'm going to read it again. This is Carla Del Ponte, the prosecutor. She said that the International Tribunal was to establish a record of events that would contribute to reconciliation of the Hutu and Tutsi communities. Failure to investigate the RPF would send an unambiguous signal that Tutsi leaders enjoyed impunity, that they were able, they were above the law, that the innocent victims of their violence did not count. And this failure would not bode well to the future of Rwanda or for the Rwandans scattered across East Africa and beyond. By the way, you're now one of those Africans scattered across East Africa and beyond. And there is a problem, isn't there? I mean, weren't they supposed to end the cult, so-called culture of impunity?
Yes, and that unfortunately has not happened. And instead, what has happened is that the ICTR and the national processes for justice in Rwanda have simply become like a victor's justice. Simply because the RPF won the civil war and ruled the country, it has certainly put there the parameters for justice that tends to look at the injustices committed against the Tutsi without looking at the injustice committed against the Hutu. And in my opinion, I do certainly agree with what Carla Del Ponte is saying, because the General Kagame and his clique of Tutsis have not been able to account for these crimes they have committed in Rwanda and the Congo. They actually have come to believe that they are untouchable, mm-hmm. and they actually, you know, brag about it with a lot of arrogance. I mean, you've heard Kagame speak, and every time he speaks, it's as if, you know, who cares? I don't give a damn. When he kills somebody, he says, I don't give a damn. When he talks about Hutus, yes. he says their sons and daughters should apologize for the sins of their fathers. When there's this whole policy of Ndi Umunyarwanda and Rwandese, which is supposed really to put a blanket of guilt on all the Hutu.
Well, by the way,
all this is a situation in which impunity at the international level and at the national level, Kagame has felt that actually he's an untouchable and he can continue the business of killing Rwandans with impunity. Mm-hmm. And that complicates the task of reconciliation and healing, because Rwanda is more polarized on ethnic lines more than ever before.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the international community is not helping, certainly media, by not pointing that out. They are painting a picture of a population that is now accommodating themselves to this general who holds all power to himself. And they're in a strange psychological zone, right? They, as you just pointed out, they're not allowed to mention that the Hutus died. And if they're all happy with that, that is rather perverse.
I mean, you should listen, Phil, if you read, I was reading a very sickening, I must say, really very sickening piece by Tony Blair. He wrote in The Guardian today. People mm-hmm. should look for it, and you should certainly look for it. He writes a piece in which he says, I mean, he's describing a country which even us as Rwandans, we cannot even begin to understand. We don't know which country he's describing. And he says, 9 out of 10 people say they are so hurt about their leader, Paul Kagame. I mean, 9 out of 10 Rwandans are so excited about
Tony Blair is very good at polls. He knows how to take a poll, particularly in a language he doesn't speak.
Yes, I mean, and so even there was a tweet by President Clinton today, which I read, you know, casting Paul Kagame in those kind of, glamorous terms. But, of course, the truth of the matter is that we Rwandans, those who are inside the country, are captive, and they are, like, fearful. They cannot speak out. We are languishing in the diaspora outside here. And these are the kind of conditions that in the past, number one, have led to civil war. Mm. And number two, if not managed properly, these are the kind of conditions that have led to such things like genocide, crimes of against humanity, and war crimes. And so we are back to square one. We are like in the pre-1959 situation. We are like in the pre-1994 situation. Yeah. The writing is on the wall. in the meantime, Kagame says he's a hero, and everybody should accept that. And then he has protectors in powerful places in London and Washington, and he has Tony Blair, a British former prime minister. He has Clinton, a former president of the most powerful nation on planet Earth. And then he has an evangelist, you know, speaking out for him. So, and yet, these are extremely, extremely dangerous times. Feel, mm-hmm. I always want to convey this message to the Rwandans who might be listening, and mm-hmm. the Africans who might be listening, or people like you, Canadians mm-hmm. and Americans who might be listening, that these are exactly very, very dangerous times, and the window of opportunity is closing on us. And Rwanda is sliding into more violence each day that passes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's up to us simply to keep on amplifying this message. And I thank your radio for taking the lead on something like this.
Yeah. Well, we're very grateful that we had you. And I'll just remind everyone that you were the Secretary General of the Rwanda Patriotic Front and the Chief of Staff to Paul Kagame, so you know we're certainly you have your own personal witness to deliver, and we appreciate it very, very much, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Fionn, and have a good evening.
Thank you. Dr. Theogen Rudasingwa, Healing a Nation, a Testimony. We'll take a break. Well, before we go to break, remember, next week we're going to be asking you for support for the program.
That's right. Membership drive starts on Wednesday. Go to ciut.fm. And we want to remind you there's many different ways to listen to this station. Right now the transmitter's not doing so well. So iTunes Radio, TuneIn Radio phone app, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946. Bell 5, Channel 970, and Star Choice Satellite, Channel 826, all different ways to listen to CIUT. Yeah. Please go to the website and pledge now. Get in on the early bird and support the Taylor Report.
Thank you. We'll take a break. We'll be back with Chris Black.